Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. I call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Monday, March 6, 2017. I want to just reiterate today we're going to hear six bills that have to do with PERS. These are what we call non-PERS reform bills, if you will. These are, every session we hear bills that impact the PERS systems, but these are not, bills that are going to dramatically change the structure of PERS, shall we say. So we're going to go ahead and have a public hearing on Senate Bill 200, which expands eligibility to purchase PERS credits time for unlimited services. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 200, and I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
This bill comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Education. It expands the eligibility for members of the public employees retirement system to purchase retirement credits to any person who entered or re-entered active service in uniform services after January 1, 1950, or who was in active service in uniform services on January 1, 1950. It defines uniform services and it declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments at this time.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call some folks to testify. We're going to start with Senator Devlin, please.
For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. Madam Chair, if I can exercise a little bit of latitude here. Today you have three bills before you that my office has worked on, SB 201 that corrects an oversight in the legislation that created the Oregon Public Service Retirement Program, often referred to as OPSERV, SB 214 that excludes certain postdoctoral scholars from PERS, and SB 200 that corrects another oversight that occurred when provisions were added to PERS that allowed PERS members with prior uniform service to purchase up to 4 years of credit at the full cost to the system of providing that benefit. I will be only speaking about SB 200 today, as I believe the parties that have come to speak on SB 201 and 214 will have a substantial case for the approval of those measures. The provisions of PERS that created the ability to purchase up to 4 years of credit for people who served in uniform services was created approximately 15 years ago. However, in these provisions, uniform services were defined more narrowly than is common in other areas in state and federal law. This issue came to my office from a constituent who found an inconsistency within the PERS statute that narrows the meaning of uniform services as written. The current law allows individuals to purchase retirement credit who are uniform services, but specifies in later subsection that this applies to the armed services. While the uniform services are commonly considered synonymous with the armed services, there are in fact two other uniform services of the United States, not as well known, but have been around for quite a long time. One is the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. This service currently has about 6,700 officers. Although they are known for their broad public health service role, they are the men and women that commonly respond to the tragic events like 9/11, or hurricanes, floods, earthquakes, and major disease outbreaks. The other uniformed service is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Commissioned Officer Corps. This service is even smaller. It currently has approximately 380 officers. NOAA, as it's known, operate the 16 ships and 10 aircraft in their service, manage research operations, diving operations, and also serve in positions in the Department of Defense, the United States Coast Guard, NASA, and the United States Department of State. Senate Bill 200 simply amends the statute to consistently use the term uniform services and extends the ability to purchase credit to all members who serve our state and nation honorably. Chair Taylor, I also want to note that while I believe this is an important change, allowing PERS members to purchase credit for prior service does not mean everyone chooses it. Based on requests by PERS members with prior teaching, which is another provision, and military service seeking to purchase credit, Only a fraction of the people who requested an estimate actually purchased the PERS credit. This is because it's usually quite expensive to do this because you're paying the full cost to the system of purchasing these 4 years in credit. For example, in 2015, of the 166 estimates that were prepared, 13 people made purchases, 5 for out-of-state teaching, which is the other provision, and 8 for prior military service. In 2016, of the 132 estimates that were prepared, 6 made purchases and 6 are pending, 5 for out-of-state teaching and 7 for military service. Given the comparative size of the armed services to the other two uniformed services, it is doubtful that more than a couple members would ever make a full cost purchase in this system. It is also important to know this change does not have a substantive fiscal impact, and should this come back for a work session, I do not believe you will see any fiscal impact on it, since these members are purchasing these additional years of credit at the full cost to the system. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, the purpose of this bill is not to expand PERS, but to treat all members of the uniformed services equally. I ask for your support of SBA 200 and appreciate your time today. The constituent that brought to me has also signed up to testify. As an aside, I've been talking to him for like 6 years, and I told him that I would look for a an uncontroversial PERS bill to bring this into. And in 6 years, I never found an uncontroversial PERS bill. And he's also approached my House member, Representative Leiniger, who's not here today. But we both think this is something that should be considered by the committee and considered by the legislature, and hope ultimately for your support.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Anybody have any? So can you just clarify, for I understand there probably won't be a fiscal, but when you say no purchasing at a full cost, can you just make sure that everyone understands, since I know you know so much about PERS, Senator Devlin, about in the long run, I think when this individual retires or any time in their life, how the public understands? Can you just clarify that there wouldn't be any additional cost to the person?
Well, I think Marjorie Taylor's here that could answer that question, and maybe she'll nod her head if my explanation is not complete. But all of these parties that would be purchasing this are obviously not money matched. They're all formula retirees because that's the only place it would apply. If they were regular service tier one, they would be 1.67%. Unless they were police and fire. So they'd be purchasing 4 times 1.67% of their average salary. They would pay the cost of that based upon their actuarial life expectancy and what it would cost the system ultimately to pay those benefits over that period of time. Most of the people that actually look into this decide that the cost is far greater than the benefit. In terms of the cost of buying this is far greater than the benefit. That's why so few people purchase it. But the reality is that in most cases it takes a very extensive period of time receiving the benefit before you've ever actually paid back the investment that you made into it. If you live longer than the actuary estimates that you will live, you will benefit by this. If you don't, if you live shorter, the state will benefit.
Okay. Anything you'd like to clarify? Of course, my next question is going to be, then why would someone do this? But thank you, Ms. Taylor, for coming. Can you state your name, please?
Sure. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, and I'm the Senior Policy Director at PERS. And frankly, Senator Devlin has answered all of the questions. That's correct. So the full cost purchase means that the member is purchasing the increase to their benefit plus the COLA increases over the anticipated actuarial lifespan of the benefit. So they're buying everything, and we will pay them back at the beginning, and then we'll pay them back incrementally as we pay out their benefit.
Okay, will you be the devil's advocate for me then? Then why would an individual do this?
So, Madam Chair, it's possible that they might outlive what they've spent to get the increase to their benefit. So, for example, as Senator Devlin has already shared, in 2015 there were people that paid anywhere from $6,000 to $123,000 to increase their benefits from $33 a month to $823 a month. And so somebody who spent $6,000 to increase by $33 a month was retiring at age 50. So it's likely that they will outlive the cost of the benefit.
Yeah,
Yes, Senator Hansel.
But is it not also true that if you sign up for it and you are successful in your estimates, then it adds to what we as the state, you know, it adds to our whole? Because at some point we are going to be paying them.
Chair Taylor and Senator Hansel, that's a very unusual full cost purchase that I illustrated. It's more likely that the full cost itself is running into the tens of thousands of dollars, if not into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And generally, people don't outlive the cost of the full cost purchase. But you are correct. There may be some small increase that we might have to pay out if they outlive the purchase.
Okay, Senator Kennelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Marjorie, do you know how many states allow workers of some type to buy credits?
Chair Taylor and Senator Knope, I sure don't know the answer to that question. We could get back to you on that.
Okay, Madam Chair, I could research that question, but I think Senator Knope knows that not all states allow this. Some states do. But the most common thing within public employees' retirement systems that you'll find in many states is the ability to purchase like the first 6 months before you become eligible. Many states allow that, so that, and that's commonly something some members do is purchase the credit for that 6 months if they're a formula retiree. Obviously not if they're money match, because it has no impact at all.
Okay, well, this is interesting because it seems like Senator Devlin, you're wanting to bring some equity across the armed forces by everyone being treated the same as how it compares. Yeah. So.
Or uniform services.
Uniform services, excuse me, I apologize.
I do realize that I have someone on the panel that public health is very important to. I don't know if she's.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And so we're going to go ahead and does anyone have any other questions? Okay. Well, we'll bring up, thank you both. Mr. Jim, or Dr. Jim Godino. Godino, yes. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Being on his coat.
Yes, you've.
It just started raining as I was approaching the building. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you to Senator Devlin, the chair, and the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of the important language changes in PERS law proposed in Senate Bill 200. I'm a former commander.
Can you say your name, please?
I'm sorry?
You just state your name, please, for the record.
Oh, yes. I'm just about to do that. I'm former Commander Dr. James A. Gaudino. I was a member of the U.S. Public Health Service, one of the seven U.S. uniformed services covered in the federal law, such as the Soldiers and Sailors Act. In the U.S. Public Health Service, I served in various assignments in states for about 12 to 13 years. And in July of 2003, I inactivated from the U.S. Public Health Service to accept a position in the Oregon Public Health Division after serving in a U.S. Public Health Service assignment from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention right here in Oregon. I also transitioned into the inactive reserve of the U.S. Public Health Service until this reserve was eliminated by the U.S. Affordable Care Act in 2010. This change eliminated my chances of rejoining or serving in active duty again with the U.S. Public Health Service. So about 8 or 9 years ago, when I was talking with a friend told me about credit purchase options in his retirement service, not part of Oregon PERS, by the way. I contacted PERS to inquire about the possibility of purchasing credit for some of my years of service in the United States Public Health Service. After phone calls and letters, I learned that though I was already in PERS and left to serve in the United States Public Health Service, that if I was already in PERS and left to serve in the United States Public Health Service, I would be able to purchase those service credits. But because my U.S. Public Health Service occurred prior to my PERS employment, purchasing service credits would not be allowed. As I dug further, I found out that the purchase of service credits prior to PERS employment was allowed for those five, you know, of the seven uniformed services, the ones called armed forces. This disparity in the treatment of former uniformed service members from different services who are in the PERS system comes down to an inconsistency in the use of the words armed forces instead of uniformed services in two important parts of PERS law, as Senator Devlin explained. This seems unfair. This seemed unfair then and still feels unfair now. Briefly, the two services covered as uniformed services but are not considered armed forces are the U.S. Public Health Service and NOAA, as Senator Devlin explained. These are relatively small and often overlooked services, yet they serve critical roles in the protection of the United States and are deployed in response when needed. The United States Public Health Service, of course, addresses in response to threats in public health. Retirement through both are handled much like the other five services, requiring a minimum of 20 years of service to gain any retirement benefits. NOAA now has a presence in Oregon, thanks to much work by state and U.S. Legislators. As mentioned in letters of support sent to Senator Devlin, which I hope will be provided to the committee, or probably has, my NOAA contacts here are certain that, as I have been affected, there will be a few NOAA officers who later serve in PERS positions who will run into the same barriers in PERS law to being able to purchase credit years in PERS. Senate Bill 200 addresses the disparity in PERS law that unfairly takes away the option of service credit purchases from the few of us who serve in these two uniformed services and then go on to work in PERS-covered positions. In my situation, I'm a public health prevention physician who chose public service over private practice work to serve the public, and because of that, throughout my career, have accepted lower compensation in public sector positions, as one would expect. A change in this PERS law language would allow me and my family the option of purchasing credits for some of my service with the U.S. Public Health Service. As I look to hopefully eventually retiring, such credit may make a difference in what my family is able to live on. My understanding, though sketchy, is that such credits can make a modest improvement in my PERS retirement income should they be become available to be purchased. And frankly, that's all I would expect or ask for. Not being able to purchase these service credits at all or to really explore them through PERS because of this disparity in PERS law language seems to me like a great injustice to the women and men who serve in these two uniformed services, however small they are, and later serve in Oregon PERS positions. Your committee has the opportunity to correct this disparity by approving Senate Bill 200. And I urge you to vote for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for coming to the Capitol today.
Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 200 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 201. And I ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
This bill is at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Education for Oregon Public Universities. It establishes that remuneration paid to eligible employees who is hired in a qualifying position by a university with a governing board on or after August 29, 2003, and on or before December 31, 2017, and who is living and performing services within the United States, is taxable income under Oregon law during the period of continuous employment with the university. There is a -1 amendment that replaces the proposed statutory change with a provision establishing that for a member of the public employee's retirement system who has been hired by a university with a governing board in that same period, actually it's 2016, and who resided and performed services in the United States for that university, remuneration paid in return for those services during the period of continuous employment is taxable income under Oregon law. And there's no other amendments.
Okay, thank you. We're going to go ahead and call up Craig Ashford, U of O General Counsel, and Joel Taven from Miller Nash, please. Thank you both for coming. Like I said, we have six bills today, so if you could each keep your comments for about 2-3 minutes each, please, that would be great. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Taylor, for the opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 201. My name is Craig Ashford, Assistant General Counsel for the University of Oregon, and I provide legal advice with respect to retirement plans matters for the University of Oregon. This bill is largely just a technical cleanup for the universities to resolve a matter that's been outstanding since 2003. The Oregon Public OPSERP has been in effect since August 29th of 2003. And since that time, there has been a new definition of salary in place. Subject salary for contributions and benefits from OPSERP excludes now income that's earned outside of the state of Oregon and therefore not taxable in the state of Oregon. And at the time, the universities of the public universities in the state of Oregon were part of the State Board of Higher Education in the Oregon University System. And there was a central office that was responsible for administering payroll and retirement benefits. And that office did not recognize that there had been a change in the definition of salary. As a result, there were a number of employees that were hired during that period from August 29, 2003, and then going forward, where they were not informed that they would have effects that could potentially result from this change in the definition of salary. The universities will regularly provide something like a benefits introduction when an employee joins, and in addition, when they would list benefits that would be offered to potential employees upon employment, they would state that the universities would provide retirement benefits without any qualifiers. And so then you would have employees who would join the universities expecting that they would receive a certain set of benefits, including retirement benefits. However, since that time, you would have a number of employees, not very large, and I believe that my colleague Joelle will cover this, but a small number of employees who would unexpectedly not receive either contributions to OPSERP on their behalf or potentially benefits on the back end. Now, since the time that OUS has dissolved, effective kind of progressively since July 1, 2014 to July 1, 2015, the universities have still been applying that rule in the same way until recently. PERS issued an employer announcement number 92 around late summer, early fall of 2015 that reiterated this rule regarding out-of-state salary that's not taxable in the state of Oregon. And around the same time, PERS noticed that there were a couple of employees that had out-of-state addresses, and I believe they just made some outreach phone calls to Oregon State University just to ask them to verify the salary information. And from there, with respect to both that phone call and with respect to the employer announcement, the universities took notice of, we need to see if we can't do right by these employees to make sure that they can get the benefits that they were hired on with the expectation of receiving them. So as a result, we have a technical cleanup here because the universities have always been contributing this money on behalf of these employees erroneously, unknowingly and erroneously, but yet these employees may not receive the benefit of these contributions. And so we'd like to make a technical change to the statute for just a very narrow, limited period of time so that those employees who are hired with that expectation would be provided with the promised benefits.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it sounds like an error was made.
Yes.
Okay, so this is, we're correcting an error, it's not necessarily a technical fix.
Yes, Chair Taylor, I believe it, yes, correct. It was an error on the part of the Oregon University System at the time, and then we had the same benefits employees that carried forward after that applying it the same way.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joelle Tavon, outside legal counsel for the seven Oregon public universities. As Craig mentioned, Senate Bill 201 will provide retirement benefits to a very limited group of employees whose compensation has not been taxable in Oregon. We're talking about 68 employees across all seven universities. The universities are mindful that retirement is a fundamental aspect of one's employment. Affected employees have received annual benefit statements from PERS showing their accrued retirement credit and the balance of their accounts. Those employees have mistakenly believed that they have earned and will continue to earn PERS benefit and are fully expecting to receive those benefits at the time of retirement. The university's primary goal is to ensure that the employees affected by this issue are made whole. A statutory amendment to retroactively include salary not taxable in Oregon would be the most cost-effective and least burdensome way to resolve this issue, because as Craig mentioned, the universities have already made and have continued to make contributions on behalf of these employees based on compensation, whether taxable in Oregon or not. If Senate Bill 201 is not enacted, affected employees would not earn any PERS retirement benefits on compensation that is not taxable in Oregon. If Senate Bill 201 is not enacted, the universities would need to examine whether they have any duty to provide a separate source of compensation or retirement benefits to those out-of-state employees. And the universities have explored the possibility of negotiating private settlement with those employees, and for many reasons, doing so would be extremely difficult. In the interest of time, I will not discuss those unless members of the committee would like to hear about those other possibilities.
I'm just interested in what the potential cost would be to OUS, to the seven universities, for these 68 employees. So if this bill did not go through, what would be the potential cost?
Chair Taylor.
Not the legal cost, the actual, just the payment cost.
Chair Taylor, that's actually one of the biggest issues, is determining the cost of providing the value of those PERS benefits to those employees, because PERS benefits are determined at the time of retirement based on contribution history, and those would not be known until the time of retirement. So the universities would basically have no idea how long those employees would work for the universities, when they would retire. So at this point in time, it's almost impossible to determine the value of PERS benefits.
Well, there would be a range, correct? You would have an estimate of a range.
Chair Taylor, may I address this? There would be a range, but it would be anywhere from $0 in terms of what they might receive from their PERS benefits, all the way up to a potential of receiving all of them. But it is impossible to know at that time, up until the time that they retire. These individuals are still eligible to participate in PERS and also would still receive PERS retirement credits. However, their salary would be counted as zero, so when you tried to multiply out their credits as compared to their salary, then you wouldn't be able to come up with any benefit on the back end. However, if one of these employees just happened to decide to come back to the state of Oregon for a period of time, let's say, for example, 3 years, they might actually receive all of their PERS benefits, but it's all based on conditional and contingent decisions that they might make in the future. And so although the universities may want to reach out to them immediately to be able to set this straight and make sure that they receive benefits that they otherwise would have believed they'd receive, it's actually impossible for us to determine that. There is a range that we could determine. However, it could be anywhere between zero and a full amount of expected benefits.
Yes. This is an interesting concept, and I'm not quite sure I'm understanding it. So,
Ms. Taylor here, if you want to bring her up, Marjorie Taylor.
Well, no, we are an income tax state, and so our revenues come from the employees that work here in the state of Oregon. These employees do not live here in the state of Oregon; they live out of state, and so their salaries are not taxed. So they're actually earning more money, really, because we're not taxing them. Am I interpreting this correct or not?
Chair Taylor and Senator.
That's probably different than the PERS thing, but I was just curious.
So it is actually, in fact, difficult to know whether or not they're making more money, because they would be located in a different state and we'd be subject to income tax in that state unless it doesn't have an income tax system such as
Washington.
Washington
that's
or wherever else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are an income tax state, And so they would not be paying into the state of Oregon's system for income tax. However, the universities are still making contributions on their behalf right now to PERS to be able to provide the money. And they're also still rendering service on behalf of a state entity, one of the universities here in the state. And so as a result, they're still generating significant benefits for members of the public for the state of Oregon. However, they just happen to be located outside of the boundaries.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 201, and we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 791, and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please. Sorry. Oh, are we out of sequence here?
I just lost my page. It's on here.
You did. Where's seven? Where's?
We are out of order, but that's okay.
No, and I don't want to be out of order. Right?
Oh,
this is
214.
214 is next. But it's not on here. Okay, sorry, we got out of order there. We're going to go with us open a public hearing on Senate Bill 214. And I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize 214, please.
Okay. This is at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Education for Oregon Public Universities. It provides that postdoctoral scholars employed by a public university or the Oregon Health and Science University beginning on or after the effective date of the Act is not eligible to become a member of the Public Employees Retirement System, Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or the Optional Retirement Plan. It provides that OHSU may not offer an alternative retirement program to a postdoctoral scholar beginning employment on or after the effective date of the Act, and it defines a postdoctoral scholar. There is a -1 amendment that replaces Section 1 with a different definition of postdoctoral scholar. Sections 2 and 3 add exceptions to the definition of employee and eligible employees, specifying that postdoctoral scholars are not eligible are not employees or eligible employees within the meaning of the PERS statutes. Section 4 deletes the provision that excludes OSU postdoctoral scholars from eligibility to participate in the ORP and provides that postdoctoral scholars shall elect to participate in ORP after completing certain requirements. It requires the governing board to contribute monthly to ORP for a participating postdoctoral scholar up to 4% of the postdoctoral scholar's salary.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call up Dr. Cassandra Mosley, Dr. Dorothy Wildenschild, and Dr. Niles Lehman. And then after that, we'll have Dr. Corona, Dr. Drelling, and Dr. Parker. And we're going to ask that everybody keep their testimony about 2-3 minutes per person. Who would like to start?
I'm happy to start. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chairman, to speak with you today about Senate Bill 214. My name is Cassandra Mosley. I'm an Associate Vice President for Research and a Research Professor at the University of Oregon. Senate Bill 214 would increase the competitiveness of Oregon's universities for federal research dollars and create new opportunities for postdoctoral training in the state by providing an alternate retirement plan for these scholars. A postdoctoral position is a really critical waypoint in the career path of physical and natural scientists. After completing their degrees, these PhDs tend to seek temporary positions at other universities where they get additional training and receive personalized mentoring before they go on to more permanent positions in the academy or in the private sector. Most postdoctoral positions are paid with federal research grants, which are extremely, as we know, extremely competitive. And including postdoctoral scholars in these grants is often a key component of of their competitiveness and their success. But the high cost of benefits in Oregon are really putting Oregon universities and their faculty at a competitive disadvantage to their peers. And federal research funding provides a significant economic impact to the state of Oregon, not only through the hundreds of millions of dollars that flow through the universities into the state each year, but through the innovation, discoveries, and workforce and education that they enable. given the crucial role in the economies of the state and in the economics of the universities, we really need to be doing all that we can to enhance the flow of federal research dollars in this increasingly difficult funding time, both at the state and federal level. So over the last few years, we have been working together with our faculty union, and other universities to find a collaboratively supported solution to address this competitive disadvantage that we all face. And this bill, inclusive of the amendment that we just heard about, is really that collaborative solution. It adjusts the postdoctoral retirement benefits to really create a key opportunity to increase the competitiveness of these grants while having a really limited impact on the postdoctoral scholars, because these are temporary employees who are at a university to be mentored and trained. The vast majority of them never vest in PERS or ORP. So this bill really does three critical things. It defined temporary employees, postdocs, as temporary employees that are being mentored. It exempts them from PERS, and it retains the immediately vesting portion of the tier four ORP, so that postdocs would still be eligible to contribute up to 4% of their salary, and that the universities would continue to match that, similar to the system in the ORP. So let me just close by saying that this is a very high priority for the University of Oregon. We really support the bill and the associated amendment because we think it's really vital to improving the research competitiveness of all the universities and increasing the flow of federal dollars to the state. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, who's next?
Okay. Chair Taylor, committee, thanks for letting me speak today. My name is Dorota Wildenschild. I'm a professor in the College of Engineering at OSU. And for the past 2.5 years, I've also served as the director of the Office of Postdoctoral Programs at OSU. In this role, I've overseen all matters related to postdocs, and in particular, I've managed the requirements around a particular postdoc scholar category we've had for a couple of years at OSU. This particular category called postdoc scholars is an affordable trainee category of postdoctoral researchers that comes with a number of constraints. And these constraints were put in place in particular to guarantee a substantial training component to the postdoc scholars' experience. I won't reiterate all the things that Dr. Mosley already talked about with respect to the value of postdocs. I wanted to talk a little bit more about this particular training experience and the value to the postdocs and to the university. So first of all, the postdocs can only hold this position for 3 years. There's a minimum stipend. They have to be supported at 1.0 FTE for the first 12 months. So we're really talking about a trainee position. They cannot be in this position once they reach 5 years beyond their receiving their PhD. And again, it's because that's one of the reasons they're trainees. They're not regular employees. One of the things that is very central to this position as well, and that I think would be incredibly valuable if we could carry that forward, is this formal mentoring program. All postdoc scholars in this particular category have to work with a set framework for setting goals. We refer to these plans as individual development plans. They have to submit these after 3 months and again revisit them with their faculty researcher after 1 year before they can get reappointed. So these required interactions using the set framework is instrumental in helping postdocs set their long-term professional goals and working on their career plans. The goal for this, besides them conducting research the way postdoc researchers normally do, is for them to have a significant advantage in the job market when it comes time for them to apply and interview for their dream job. Now, they're called individual development plans because they're going to look very different depending on whether the postdoc wants to be a professor, whether they want to work in industry, or work for the Nature Conservancy. Reading all of these plans and annual reports, which was part of my job, has really brought out to me how well the training aspect works for this category of postdoc. When the PI, the faculty mentor, and the postdoc work together on setting these goals for the future. So the postdocs are provided an opportunity to finally tune their training during their training period. And the goal is for them to long-term come out with a clearer path to where they want to be and really obtain the training they need. And this kind of temporary position really allows them to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, thank you very much for letting me testify in strong favor of Senate Bill 214. For the record, my name is Niles Lehman, and I'm a full professor of chemistry at Portland State University. I'm here to say that the faculty at Portland State University are overwhelmingly in support of this bill, and we've been trying to get something like this effected in the state legislature for many years. The value of this bill is that it will be a lot easier for faculty such as myself to hire postdoctoral fellows in the state of Oregon and make our competitiveness with other states on more equal footing. And it would bring jobs and a lot more research activity to the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. Does anyone have any questions? Yes?
I'm confused on this bill. What you're saying is you don't want these postdoctoral scholars to be in the PERS system. Is that how I'm reading it? And right now they are?
Correct.
As well as the alternative retirement system. So right now they're in PERS and they
can elect, like all university employees, when they become eligible to join PERS or the ORP. This bill would exclude them from PERS and provide an alternative benefit through the ORP that includes only the part that's immediately vested in the Tier 4, not the university contribution that takes many years to vest, and they would no longer be by the limitations, at least at Oregon State and University of Oregon and our collective bargaining agreement, they would no longer be at the university when that vesting period came.
So this is advantageous for the postdoctoral student.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. We're going to go ahead and call up the next Dr. John Perona, Michael Drelling, and Philip Parker, please. In the interest of time, go ahead and start, please.
Okay, Chair Taylor and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. I just want to focus on two quick points that haven't been covered before.
Okay.
For the record, I'm professor of chemistry at Portland State University. First point is that Portland State is in the process of transitioning to a full-fledged research university, and at the present time, we don't have the physical infrastructure and the endowment that University of Oregon and Oregon State University have. So it's particularly important for us to not be laboring at a disadvantage with respect to being able to hire postdoctoral fellows as compared to competitive researchers in most other states, if not all other states in the country. Also, of course, Portland is two-thirds of the population of the state of Oregon, and the ripple effects on investment and businesses that could occur if faculty grants could be better targeted towards research could be substantial. So many corporations, many startup companies are started by faculty, and faculty who have to spend all their time teaching undergraduates and grad students and cannot offload some work to postdoctoral scholars are at a disadvantage to be able to do things like that. They really grow the economy. So that's the first point. The second point is that many of us are concerned that our federal grants are being inappropriately taxed. That is to say, it's an inappropriate conversion of funds because the postdoctoral fellow cannot benefit because he or she doesn't vest. That those funds basically amount to a support of Oregon PERS in taxing federal funds, and that may amount to a misappropriation of federal grant funds. And so we're concerned about that, and this bill would fix that. Thank you.
Okay. Hello, Chair Taylor. Senators, thank you for having me here. My name is Michael Drelling, and I'm a professor of sociology and president of United Academics at the University of Oregon. United Academics is a union that represents about 1,800 faculty, which include postdoctoral scholars, tenure-track faculty, non-tenure-track faculty, librarians, and the like. We have about 65 postdoctoral scholars represented by our union, and we fully support this bill. And the reason we do support this. Is since the timing, you know, in 2011, 2012, when we were organizing as a union, we encountered many conversations with colleagues, tenure track faculty on the one hand, who are as PIs, struggling with the issue of having postdoctoral scholars hired under grants that they were elating, that were oftentimes federal or private grants, that would then have a big portion of those grants consumed by this PERS contribution in the OPE. And so what they were wanting was a fix to this. And, of course, the university administration wanted a fix to this as well. And so we were on the same page with the university administration and faculty, tenure-track faculty, but also postdoctoral scholars who also found themselves oftentimes applying for and obtaining federal or private grants, having to budget a substantial sum in their own grant proposals for making these PERS contributions that would also put them at a disadvantage relative to other postdoctoral scholars, fellows, or faculty applying for these funds outside of the state of Oregon. And so we have since then been in a fairly regular collaborative kind of problem-solving conversation with university administration at the University of Oregon to figure out how to solve this problem. And I think the problem has been explained. You have postdoctoral scholars who are, you know, there for 3 years, up to 5 years, typically, at the most, and they never have the opportunity to vest in the PERS system. As a result, that money that had moved out of either private grant funds or federal grant funds into the PERS system never comes back to the postdoctoral scholars as they leave into other permanent employment elsewhere. And so that's essentially the problem. And then what that does to our research capacities at our universities is the next level problem created by this first initial situation. And so I want to speak as, again, president of United Academics in favor of this, and also note that our postdoctoral scholars who we represent overwhelmingly support this as well. They're an active part of our membership of our union. Dr. Parker here, who's a postdoctoral scholar, will speak to this in a moment. And I also want to point out that the tenure track faculty, who often are in and out of our bargaining unit as principal investigators, also support this this bill. So thank you so much for your time. I'd be happy to take any questions if you have any.
How many people would this impact? How many postdoctoral students do the seven universities have, or are you just here for the University of Oregon?
I'm just here for the University of Oregon, and our union represents 65 postdoctoral scholars. There are additional postdoctoral fellows and others at the University of Oregon, but within our bargaining unit, who we represent, 65. The numbers are much larger, of course, when you include OSU, U of O, and ultimately later on, I guess, PSU. But
so it's just obviously the three U.S. research universities.
That's right.
The regional schools. And you are, sounds like you're stating that you think this is an impediment to people actually choosing to come and have their postdoctoral experience at one of our three research schools.
Well, there's a couple problems. One is when you have to budget for a grant to a federal agency or a private agency, you've got to put in and put out the costs of what it is going to take to hire that postdoctoral scholar. So it makes those grant proposals less competitive, first of all. And so in already, you know, tight granting conditions, right, this is already makes an already difficult job more difficult. And then, of course, it's a problem in the sense that the men and women who are postdoctoral scholars never get to see this benefit that is being paid out on their behalf. And so you have both levels of problem occurring. And then, of course, the difficulty of continuing to attract postdoctoral scholars if you don't have the reliable research funding.
Okay, so then if the postdoctoral student went on to become a faculty member at one of our three research universities, what then?
What then would ideally the options remain to stick with the ORP, alternative investment for retirement, right, that they would also be eligible to invest in and then continue on as a faculty member if they're hired in another faculty position.
I'm saying regarding PERS.
Regarding PERS.
Yes. So if they were there for 3 years as a postdoctoral student and then got on a tenure track,
yeah,
then would those three in the bill, is that addressed? Would those would those postdoctoral students be able to, if they went on as a tenured, would that those 3 years continue on to their contribution to PERS, or they would just never be eligible for PERS?
They would be eligible for PERS as a tenure track faculty person.
But would you count in the 3 years of postdoctoral?
No, not with my understanding of the bill. What would they be able to do is to have a more portable benefit. And if I'm, no. Maybe I'm speaking incorrectly on this, so I can't say for certain then.
Okay, all right, that's okay.
Let somebody else address that question.
Go ahead. Oh. We have to pace. I appreciate you coming. We need to maybe keep it for about 2 minutes, please.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Chair Taylor and members of the committee, thank you very much for having me. Mm-hmm. My name is Dr. Philip Parker, and I'm a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Oregon. I'm also co-chair of the UO Postdoctoral Association. Because Senate Bill 214 directly affects us as postdoctoral scholars, I believe it's essential that you hear it unequivocally from a representative postdoc that we fully support this bill and are in agreement with the testimony that you've heard today from the university and union representatives. The state must make it affordable for our universities to hire and retain postdoctoral scholars. With us being eligible currently for the public employees retirement system, that's not possible. And so the system currently weighs very heavily on our research funds, and we ultimately don't benefit at all from this supposed benefit, as has been explained today. So I thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to take questions.
Okay. I think I was going to have Marjorie just clarify.
Yeah,
if we don't mind. We're going to, gentlemen, if you can, thank you so much. We're going to have Marjorie Taylor from PERS come and explain what's going on here so we understand.
I'd like to hear, yes.
Sure. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, Senior Policy Director at PERS. We're happy to have had the opportunity to work with the universities on the language in the bill. Appreciate that there's the amendment, and we, of course, would need some additional amendments. Okay. But we'll continue that conversation afterwards. So from what I understand, with ORP, and maybe Craig can help out with that, there's a one-time election for university employees to choose whether they want to participate in PERS or with ORP. So it's unclear to me whether postdocs who are now proposed to go into ORP would then have the opportunity to select to go back to PERS if they become full-time faculty, or whether when they become tenure track positions, whether they could have the opportunity to go back to PERS, but they would not have the 3 years or 5 years, four and 11 months worth of postdoc time would go to their PERS. They wouldn't go there under this bill.
Yeah, that's something serious consideration when making decisions for future postdoc students.
Sure, exactly. So if you're a postdoc at OSU and you go to tenure track at U of O, then would you make, first of all, you would be in a PERS-covered position at U of O as a tenure track professor, but would you have the opportunity to choose to go to PERS even though you've been in ORP as a postdoc? So that's really kind of some of the question.
Okay, well, I'll leave all of you to go and have that conversation then. Does anybody have any other questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 214 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 464. And I'm going to call up, I'm going to have Deborah summarize the bill, please.
Thank you. This bill is sponsored by Senator Boquist at the request of John and Tony Boyer. It directs the Public Employees Retirement Board to reimburse retired PERS member for any reduction of benefits payable on or before December 31st, 2014, based on an erroneous determination that benefits were not subject to Oregon personal income tax due to non-residency. The bill sunsets January 2nd, 2019, and declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no amendments at this time.
Okay, I'm going to call up Ms. Peggy Boquist from Senator Boquist's office, please. Hello, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Peggy Boquist, Dallas, Oregon. Today I'm representing Tony Boyer, a constituent in our district, who in 2013 was denied her full PERS benefit due to an error. And the error had to do with her residency. She's in Oregon. She's an Oregonian. She owns property in Oregon. She pays taxes in Oregon. But for some reason, she was on a list to be reviewed, probably because she has property in Mexico, and they do live in Mexico in the wintertime. Her husband suffers from a lung disorder, and they can't take this wet weather in Oregon during the wintertime. But she is an Oregonian. She's an Oregon taxpayer, and she retired from the educational work. So she fell through the cracks, so to speak. She was identified as a non-Oregon taxpayer, which was erroneous. The Oregon Department of Revenue has cleared that up, but it was too late to meet the suspense for the appeal for her denial. We have worked with the PERS board, Mr. Rodman, and many others in PERS who have been very sympathetic to this issue of Tony Boyer. And we have come to this situation where we believe that we must ask for a change in the law, the statute. We can't seem to resolve it any other way. When I asked Mr. Rodman for an alibi, for an exception to policy, he said, Peggy, this isn't the Army. We can't do that. We have laws, and we have to obey them. And so what he even suggested to me is that we may use this as a resolution. Not that he endorsed it, but he did say this is possibly what we can do to help this constituent. Since we have been down this road for about 3 years, we have actually discovered there are others that fall into this loophole. And it's very few, but it does exist out there. So helping Tony Boyer will also help other Oregonians who may have been missed the short fuse suspense to appeal and give them what I believe is right and just. The money that's due to them. Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, Senator.
What figures are we looking at? Do you know?
In the case of Mrs. Boyer, it's $1,500. It's 1 year, 2013.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for coming up. We're going to go ahead and call up J.L. Wilson and Don Doms.
Thank you, Chair Taylor and committee members. My name is Don Domes. I'm a licensed tax consultant, almost 30 years in the Hillsborough, Oregon area. Senate Bill 464 addresses some of the persistent issues with the PERS portion of the retirement benefit that's tied to being an Oregon resident subject to Oregon income taxes. PERS evaluates this on an annual basis. They have two ways to determine if a person is an Oregon resident. The first is via a timely filed tax return with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and the second is via a very simple residency status certification form where a person signs under perjury that they're an Oregon resident subject to Oregon income tax. The tax return has to be filed by October 15th, or the PERS residency certification form has to be filed with PERS by December 15th. If either of these are not completed by the due date, then the entire next year's pension benefit is impacted. Essentially, if for some reason a person's tax return does not get included in the Oregon Department of Revenue file that's given to PERS after the October 15th deadline, then PERS will send out a letter to the constituent. Well, that letter generally doesn't arrive till the middle of November because of the timing of getting the file from ODR, et cetera. The person then needs to respond to that letter by December 15th. If a person is left on vacation or misses the letter for some reason and doesn't file the Oregon resident subject to Oregon income tax form, then the entire following year's benefit is reduced. The letter that PERS sends out informing the person of the reduction then comes after December 15th, usually very late in December, and the letter advises that an appeal can be submitted. Many of us are familiar with appeal processes. So I saw a situation where this happened this last year. The appeal was created. Abundant evidence was provided that the person was an Oregon resident subject to Oregon income tax, and the first appeal, to my surprise, was denied. The letter said the appeal denied could be appealed again, so we sent a second appeal. That was denied. There was a third appeal process. That was denied. This process continued. Eventually, what we found out is that although the people at PERS were very polite, very kind, wonderful, what they ultimately told us is there is no statutory authority for them to adjust this thing until the very next year comes up. So the people are basically in that position for an entire year. We verified this with two Portland law firms. So my suggestion is that you amend this bill to give PERS statutory authority to honor the appeals and adjust the benefit on a quarterly or three-month basis so that once the residency facts are provided in the appeal, that PERS could actually honor the appeal that comes in. The present system only allows for a determination annually, and essentially the way people that are affected by this look at it is that the appeal process is a sham, and they can't understand why, if they do the appeal and provide all the technical details, that it can't be honored. So basically what I've gotten to now is that every PERS retired person that I deal with and advise, I suggest to them to file that PERS residency form every year, whether they need to or not, to make sure that if anything fouls up with the file from ODR, that then they've got this thing on file. Now, I believe that's probably additional paperwork for PERS, et cetera. I hate having them do that, but I can't figure out any other solution to kind of help with this thing. And what happens is, in many cases, the least among us are the ones that miss this thing because of being on vacation or whatever and then get impacted for a year. And I want to compliment Senator Boquist for working with the constituent who needed that help.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing the Oregon PERS Retirees Association, in support of Senate Bill 464. And the only recommendation that I would have is that the bill probably needs to be expanded, sort of in line with what Mr. Dom suggested. I was first made aware of this issue with a woman here locally named Charlotte Christ, who missed the filing deadlines. She was dealing with end-of-life issues for her husband, and it just the deadline blew by her. These are people living on fixed incomes for whom $100, $150 a month is a very significant amount of money, and she subsequently lost an entire year of the tax remedy payment because she missed the deadlines. And we publicized that story in our organization, and lo and behold, we had numerous examples of folks similarly situated with health issues, end-of-life issues, who had missed filing deadlines to certify residency and, in fact, missed out on tax remedy payments, and these are folks that were living, again, on fixed incomes. So the bill, Senate Bill 464, fixes an issue prior to December 31st, 2014. I would recommend it be an ongoing issue. I don't see a reason to have that particular date in statute. It would fix Ms. Christ's situation that I alluded to, certainly fixes Senator Boquist's constituent, but it is an ongoing issue that I don't think has a time cap on it. And so I think an amendment that would make it an ongoing issue as opposed to dealing with those cases prior to December 31st, 2014 would be appropriate. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Yep.
But
this bill that we currently have is just very specific, and it's only good for a year or two. It really doesn't affect the long going.
Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead
much.
And close the public hearing on Senate Bill 464. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 791. And ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 791 was sponsored by the Senate Committee on Workforce. It eliminates the limitation of hours. A public employer may re-employ any retired member of the public employee's retirement system in any calendar year without the suspension of the member's retirement benefits. It establishes a six-month waiting period after the member's retirement before a public employer may re-employ the member. It clarifies that such employment does not affect the status of a person as a retired member of the PERS system and a recipient of retirement benefits. There are no amendments before you at this time.
Okay. Do you want to speak now or later?
I can speak later.
I'm going to go ahead and call up Jason Meyer and Scott Winkles, please.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. This issue was brought to us to the league on by the Chiefs Association. Currently, there is we have several challenges with filling our police departments. The number of classes at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training have been reduced. If you're following that issue, the amount of time it takes to get a police officer from point of hire to retire to being working on the street without supervision is roughly 18 months. Sheriff Meyer will correct me if I'm wrong in that time frame. Additionally, when we analyze the bill, we have a number of other career fields that are very difficult currently to fulfill. For instance, you can't run your wastewater treatment plant unless there's somebody on staff who has the appropriate license and certifications. Similar requirements are in place for drinking water. The point is, these are positions we're talking about that must be staffed. While ideally we would look at retirement schedules, plan out hiring scenarios, and plans and trains and training issues and secure academy dates, that's not possible right now. Workforces are flexible, they ebb and flow. What the legislature has done previously is to sort of create a list where sort of we said there are no 1039 exceptions except for when there are. And so instructors and other positions, what this bill simply does is require that there be that the exemption be within the public interest. That would make it, we believe that would make it easier for the agency and also to address the flexible workforce needs. So employers aren't simply coming back every time we can't find there's a labor shortage and we need to fill a critical staffing role. And with that, I will turn it over to Sheriff Meyer.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Chiefs of Police, who support Senate Bill 791. And Scott kind of articulated it fairly well. We're really hitting kind of what I characterize as the perfect storm in law enforcement in terms of hiring. We have historic low unemployment. We have seen less individuals interested in the career field of law enforcement. And as Scott mentioned, when we bring them on board, which our hiring process are lengthy because we want only the best people to protect our communities, the training process takes an extremely long period of time. In those gaps, when we have people retire or they leave an organization, or because it's so competitive, they're moving from police organization, those that are certified, we oftentimes depend on retirees who have a long record, are suitable to fill in those short-term voids while we're bringing new people into the workforce. In my office alone, that 1,039 restriction means that when we have a retiree that's filling a void for us until we can get a new employee on board, we have to watch those hours really closely to make sure that we don't go over those hours and penalize the individual. So lifting this restriction would help us tremendously in public safety, keeping our positions in the jail, our positions on patrol filled while we're out there recruiting and doing our best to retain, you know, quality staff. So this is an important measure. It, as Scott mentioned as well, as it's in those jurisdictions that are eligible, that are below the thresholds, it's worked very nicely for those jurisdictions. This would enable larger jurisdictions such as mine to be able to take advantage of the retired folks.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Just a comment. Yes. You know, public perception is everything, and everyone's worried about double dipping, and especially when fire and police can retire so early, they still have a lot of years left on them. So I think that's why the hours were put on. I understand the issue. I wish there was some kind of compromise we could make so it wouldn't be perceived as double dipping, but maybe, I don't know a whole lot about it, but there is that perception.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to that.
Sure. You know,
the areas where we, Madam Chair Taylor, Senator Moniz Anderson, I understand the perception issue and something that we have, the cities have wrestled with in the past. But again, where we see this, where we felt this most deeply is in areas where the employee is required to have a certain certification. That typically that certification is a requirement that comes from either the state or the federal government. We have no dispute with requirement that our officers be DPSS certified, but the state hasn't, with respect, the state has not fully funded that agency or funded the number of classes necessary for us to keep pace with demands. Additionally, the number of people who have to have certain environmental certifications in order to keep the water, the wastewater out and the fresh drinking water in, going in, those requirements are external requirements, and there's only so many people to fill those spots.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to call up Don Doms and Bob Livingston. And did you want to comment while you're coming up, or you want to wait till the end? Okay. Okay. Don, you want to go first? It says here that you're neutral on the bill.
Yes, I'm neutral on the bill. I successfully worked with Representative Comp and Representative Davis in the 2015 session to add CTE teachers to the exceptions list because we're so short on CTE teachers, and now with ballot measure 98, we're going to be even shorter. During that work that I did on that, I discovered several things. Number one, I did discover that you can get a job category added to the list working with the legislative process. As a tax accountant, one of the things that I'm seeing is, as I'm watching, of course, W-2s come in for tax returns, I'm seeing that some public employers are essentially using a private temp service to then hire, basically the private organization hires the retired person back and then essentially provides them back to the public organization like a temp service, which is an amazing thing to me because that doesn't seem to be consistent with the law kind of a deal. But it seems to be working. We're hiring people back on a contracting basis and then not falling under the PERS 1039-hour rule. So I am neutral to negative on this because I feel there's things that are there. There's a body of law that's worked with us for a long time. We've got the public perception issue. But I'm also especially sensitive to the testimony that was just shared because I can tell you we have a set of job categories that aren't on the exception list where it is extremely difficult to get the kind of people that we need timely, et cetera. And I hear that from employers, both public as well as private in our sector. So that's, I don't have a solution on this one, but that's what I wanted to share.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Livingston.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston, president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And for background of this bill, I think most of you know that I've lingered in these hallways for over 20 years on this particular subject matter. But some of you may not know also that I've spent over 25 years in public safety, specifically in the fire service. And I'm also a past chair of the Fire Policy Committee and executive member of the Board on Public Safeties and Standards and Training. And so the Oregon State Firefighters stand in strong opposition to Senate Bill 791 and for four general areas. The first is I think, first of all, there needs to be a greater public policy discussion on some of the things that I think you heard some of the previous speakers mention, those issues of recruitment and retention, 21st century public workforce, and really none of those really get to the basis of successor planning. They may solve a short-term problem as we address some of those, but you're really not going to address some of these things that I know specifically to the PERS coalition. We've tried to tackle this with the PERS agency, with PERS employers many times over past sessions, and I think I would agree that it's a complex issue. The four areas that I want to point out to you are, one, issues of fairness. Let's not forget that over 50% of our current workforce is comprised of OPCERT members. What we do know from previous testimony and previous hearings on that is absolutely unequivocally that workforce has a less generous benefit than Tier 1 people. And so even though those reforms have impacted all people, I think you need to keep in mind that from a fairness standpoint, you've got people that we're trying to recruit and retain that already have a lesser pension and retirement security, and they're trying to solve the problem for, as an example, a water permit issue or a person that has expertise. The history behind the 1,040-hour rule was especially for those small jurisdictions that if you have a small workforce that you need to get time to get somebody a certification, you have certain time to plan and prepare for that. So again, from the successor planning, 791 is not going to do anything to address that issue, and then it also is going to couple in issues of fairness. The second area that's a problem that I do believe is an issue of understanding benefits. One of the things I think that you've tried to tackle your hands around is good, bad, or indifferent, the pension system we have here in Oregon is complex. And what I can suggest to you is that as more members, whether you're a Tier 1, Tier 2, or an OPSERP member, the more you understand your benefits, and if you look at some of the information that has been provided to this committee, here's what we do know. The reforms of 2003 have reduced the benefit sides. They haven't necessarily addressed some of the unfunded actuarial liabilities that we've talked about, but it truly has, and pers by the numbers, do point out that because we've really eliminated the money match system, we're simply a formula system. And so my point to that is, if you are a member that starts to understand and educate yourself on retirement security, what would be the benefit that if you have a lesser benefit and you're under a full formula, not sure there's a lot of benefit to retire under that because you're simply not going under the money match. So again, not sure from a successor planning that you're going to be able to resolve that. The third issue that I think I'd like to briefly talk to you about is that if you look at Section 1, Sub 3 of the bill, there's a very specific reason why you have to be out of employment for 6 months. And the reason for that is you guys, as the plan sponsor of PERS, one of the things that you absolutely have to make sure that you're in compliance with is federal tax law. And so, again, going back to some of the previous people that are suggesting, hey, this is going to solve that problem because we have a short lag in the workforce. Simply, you know, saying, hey, you're not eligible until 6 months from now, is that going to pass federal tax law when all it is a little sleight of hand? I would suggest to you that, hey, I'm retiring, but I really didn't move my job, but I'm still working at the same job for those 6 months. And does it throw the plan into compliance issues? I would venture to guess that would be something that, again, from a larger, broader discussion before we think this is the best bill in the world, something that we'd want to consider. And then finally, I think, and these aren't my numbers, these PERS, I know the agencies here, and this information is out there on their website, and they do a good job, and you know, I know that Mr. Rodeman does a great job and all of his staff with this. There is actuarial impacts to this, and this will be my final point. Just in 20, these are not my numbers, these are PERS numbers. In 2015 alone, over $168 million of payroll did not include payments to the pension system because of exceptions and because of some of these things that over years, this is where I would agree with the previous speakers, over the last 20 years, we've made exceptions here, we've done this here, we've done that there. What I can suggest to you is that Milliman, the actuaries for PERS, would say, hey, this is something that you want to pay attention to when you start exempting so many people from these. And now they're not contributing into the defined benefit portion of that, there are ramifications for that. And again, I just remind you that $168 million in 2015 payroll didn't contribute to those issues. And so I'm one that likes to provide solutions to committees. My solution to this committee would be, like we have done in previous years, and even in 2003, as an example, in the reforms, and I know at least one of the committee members was involved in this. You do have a PERS Legislative Advisory Committee that's comprised of both employers and employees, along with other work groups that could really tackle this and really give back to this body a better understanding of what are those needs for the public workforce, what are the ramifications of doing some of these things so that we don't have unintended consequences. And so what I would suggest to you as a solution is that you simply do a moratorium on any additional exceptions to the 1,040 rule. You slow down on passing a legislation like this. Let the people that are representative of labor and of employers, whether that's at the local level, the state level, special district level, the education level. Really, how do we tackle this and come back and give some recommendations on what would do that? Because I think historically, good, bad, or indifferent, there are unintended consequences to making changes to the system. And that's why, of these reasons, why we oppose Senate Bill 791.
Okay. Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any particular questions for Bob or Don, but I do have a comment, and I think it is simply this, is that I think if we moved forward with something like this, we would only likely do so if it was in combination with other changes to the PERS system. And I think the bill definitely needs amendments, and we're obviously sensitive to the tax ramification issue. So I would see it as limited to a period of time, and I think somebody mentioned that, and maybe it was you, but that it be in the public interest. So I know that firefighters and police officers and teachers testified that they would have trouble filling many of the positions that they currently have should there be an exodus of a larger proportion than normal. And so obviously we're looking to be able to mitigate that in a reasonable way, because obviously we wouldn't look to create an emergency, because I know that there's, well, tens of thousands of employees that could retire today, and many of them exist in the public safety arena and obviously in the educational realm. So I think we'll certainly take a look at the concerns that you've addressed and try to work with you all to come up with the best policy should we move forward on that and other reforms.
Okay. Any questions? Sorry. Anyone make a statement of any type? Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. It's clarifying statements there. So I'm going to go ahead and close a public hearing on Senate Bill 791 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 811. And Deborah, can you summarize the bill, please?
This bill is sponsored also by the Senate Committee on Workforce. It classifies as a police officer under the Public Employees Retirement System any employee of the Oregon State Hospital. It applies police and fire level of benefits to service performed on or after the effective date, declares an emergency and effective on passage, and there are no amendments currently.
Okay, so I'm going to call up Brant Johnson and Dan Torres, please. And while they're coming up, I want to apologize to Jose Payden. I don't know if he's still here. I failed to bring him up on Senate Bill 214. I just wanted to apologize. We had a little mix-up. I'm sorry about that. Thank you for coming. You can submit your testimony, though, in writing if you like. So, okay, gentlemen, who is going to go first?
I'll start. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Brant Johnson. I'm a member of SEIU, and I currently work at Oregon State Hospital as the Crisis Intervention Coordinator. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 811 and to tell you about the work I do a little bit and why I believe state hospital workers should be included in the high-risk, high-stress category of PERS. I've worked at the hospital for 10 years now, and most of that as a mental health therapist in the most secured portions of the hospital. The high-risk, high-stress designation of PERS started as a designation for police and fire, and over the years, the legislature has chosen to add other professions. This was done in recognition that there are some jobs that are inherently dangerous. There are some jobs that leave workers with a shorter lifespan, and this designation is intended for those physically rigorous and dangerous occupations. This designation allows workers to retire at an earlier age and have a slightly higher benefit factor used in calculating their retirement benefits. Personally, for me, during my time at the state hospital, I, like most of my colleagues, have sustained numerous injuries and now carry physical and emotional scars. My right shoulder, my left hand, and my knee pretty much hurt every day. I'm still recovering from an injury that I just recently had on my left shoulder in last September. And that's the physical stuff. The emotional stuff. I used to go to concerts all the time, go to plays, have fun going to school, sporting events. But due to my PTSD that I have now, those things aren't as fun as they used to be, and I tend to avoid them. One of my colleagues who wanted to be here today, Brandy Aguirre, is at home, has been out for 9 months due to her 9th concussion. Doctor's not sure that he'll ever let her come back to work. And this is a story that a lot of state hospital workers fear because they've seen it happen. You get hurt in the line of duty, you're no longer able to do that job, and then you end up in a lesser paying, less recognition job, or sometimes not working at all. And I think I can speak for her, and I can certainly speak for myself. I wouldn't wish it away. I wouldn't take it back. I love my job. It's rewarding. There's something about taking care of Oregon's most vulnerable and often forgotten population that is very rewarding. I would not give it up. In my role as a trainer at the state hospital, I would say it is safer than it was. We are making improvement. Things are getting better. We're continuing to work on improving safety for the employees that work there and for the patients that live there. It is safer than it was, but it will never be completely safe or stress-free. Forensic mental health will always be a stressful and potentially dangerous job. It takes a very special kind of person to face very scary situations, be physically assaulted, be emotionally traumatized, and come back the next day with positive enthusiasm to serve the patients. PERS was designed for a worker to work 30 years and then retire. 30 years in forensic mental health is far too long to be on top of your game. The patients of the Oregon State Hospital deserve the best staff that we can hire, and those staff deserve to be recognized for their sacrifice and their service to their community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you for your service. I can't even imagine how hard your job is, and I'm sorry you've had to go through all of those things. It's very serious, so I wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Torres.
All right, excellent. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, thank you much for letting me speak today. I'm going to make it short because I know there's time constraints, and I think Brant exemplified the merits and the reasons for this bill very much in the day-to-day work that he does. Oregon has to represent 25,000 workers statewide, including folks at the Oregon State Hospital working in both nurse and psychology. And we're promoting and testifying in support of this bill. We think it's right, and it's a good thing to support folks that work in this high-risk, high-stress environment. And just as Brant said, it's something that they take very seriously and provide a lot of really good quality care and service, and I think they should be rewarded for that. So we just want to testify in favor of this bill, and thank you for having this public hearing on it.
Yes, Senator Gossett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. And I wanted to thank you for the language that you're using around high stress, high risk. The challenge that I continue to have with the legislation is that the words in the legislation are still police and fire, and people that are working with people with disabilities are not police officers. And for individuals in those service sectors, given a history of loss of freedom, inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint, which is not what I'm saying that you're doing, becomes a very meaningful issue. So I hope that if we do move forward on this, we worked with AFSCME last session, and kind of the deal of the conversation that was struck was before anything else was added, we would address those words, because it is deeply offensive and concerning to people with disabilities to just have the workforce of support workers be called police, because these people aren't incarcerated, they're not under arrest, they are in a healing place to receive treatment and support. So if we were to move forward, I hope that we could look at the language. I really appreciate the language that you've used. It's not about the merits of the bill, but to the disability community, that language is deeply, deeply troubling, and continuing the conversation in this format is a little bit at odds with the discussions that were had with AFSCME last session when there was an addition.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hansel?
How many, what's the number of employees that would be qualified under this bill that would be added to the?
As written, I believe it's about 2,500, but that's shooting from the hip. And if I may, Senator Gelser, I agree. I don't want to be called a police officer. That's no way shows what I want to do in my job. And I believe that the state hospital workers perform a very risky and stressful duty that requires us to be on the top of our game. And it would make it a lot worse to be called police officers. I don't want to be called that.
And to be clear, it's not the concept. It's it's the words, and in some places, words matter a lot. The sentence.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
All right. So thank you both. I really appreciate it. And then close the public hearing on Senate Bill 811. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, March 8th. We will have work session on Senate Bill 298 and public hearings on four bills concerning various workforce issues. So on Wednesday, we are not going to talk about PERS at all, right?
Correct.
Okay. You're not going to come then? Oh, come on. We have other things to discuss here. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay. We have a little note here. Okay.
Mr. Wagner,
can't keep away from us.
I'm not sure. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't have any notes from that. Okay, all right. Okay, we can open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 811. Go ahead, and Ms. Laura Walker and Steve Barrett.
Hi there, Senator Taylor, Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Laura Walker. I'm a 28-year staff at the state hospital. I'm a just under a 35-year staff with the state of Oregon. And I would have to say I'm totally in agreement with what Brandt has brought forward. And I haven't read the whole language in it. But what I will say is I worked maximum security with people who would all be at prison if they weren't in the state hospital. So in that sense, the wording of it, you know, may be offensive to some people, but the reality is they are there for a reason. And it is the, when I look back on my time now, I've been retired for a year and a half. And when I look back on my time now, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how coworkers do it. I don't know how these other folks do it. And not to have more recognition for the dangerousness of the job. I feel very lucky to have retired with my teeth intact, no broken bones. The PTSD is there wherever I go. If I go to a restaurant to eat or wherever I go, I make sure that I can see what's out in front of me in case I need to get out of there. So there's things that follow you after retirement, and there's groups of people that are currently under police and firemen who do not have any of the risks associated with what staff at the state hospital have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for reopening the hearing. I appreciate it. It wasn't my intention to testify.
That's okay.
Initially.
We just are time sensitive getting to something. Welcome. I'm sorry we passed over you. I apologize.
My name is Steve Barrett. I also am a retiree from the state hospital. I worked there for 32 and a half years.
Goodness, you too. Amazing public servants. Fantastic.
My first 12 years was working on a sex offender unit. From there, I transferred into our security department, and from there, I transferred within our security department into transportation. And transportation at the state hospital is a little bit different. It's not necessarily on campus. It's off campus. That's almost exclusively what I did. I did the admissions, the discharges, court appearances, hospital appointments, doctor's appointments, social appointments, you name it, I did it, some out of state even. And the price that you pay for the vigilance to do that job in that entire 32 and a half years in the areas that I worked in, there were zero escapes. Now, you hear a lot of escapes with the state hospital, but they didn't happen where I worked and the jobs that I did because of the vigilance that was necessary to make that a secure place. Along with Lori, I worked at times in the maximum security departments. I worked in a variety of things. And throughout that whole thing, I wasn't ever seriously injured. Until the end of my career, I really didn't notice any physical changes. And then shortly before I retired in August of 2013, I began to notice that I was having difficulty when I'd go and exercise at the gym. And for me, when I talk about exercising, I would get on an exercise cycle and do it for 2 hours at a time. at long periods of time. And I began to have struggle to do that. And I didn't really pay any attention to it until about 7 months after I retired. And then I was diagnosed with an enlarged heart. And at this point in time, I have what's called an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. And I attribute a lot of what happened to me as a result of the stress of working in that environment. It's a corrosive environment. It's not that when I say corrosive, I don't mean that it's a physically necessarily dangerous kind of place. But to keep all of those sorts of things secure and to do my job well, I had to be on the top of my game. And I got to the point where I had to retire. But all of this I paid a price for over those 32 years. I was not the sort of person, when you looked at me, I never did drugs. I never smoked. I didn't drink. I was diagnosed with idiopathic cardiomyopathy, which essentially means they don't know why your heart swelled up, but it did. And it started right at the end of my career. And I consider myself fortunate to have been able to retire and have the life that I have. And I've since been able to recover mostly physically. But it illustrates the problem that you wind up with when you stay too long in an environment like that. That's why I'm a big supporter of what we call PNF. I don't like the title either, Senator Gelser. I think it's a misnomer. I think it's over a period of years become to mean a whole lot of other things. But unfortunately, it's the nomenclature that we have to deal with. And it's the only mechanism that the people who would benefit from this, I'm certainly not one of those people who would benefit from this. That's the only mechanism that they have. So please don't say, well, I perhaps oppose this because I don't agree with what we call it. And I agree with you, it's difficult to be called to have that nomenclature. You don't want that kind of thing in a therapeutic environment. But it's very important for the people who come after us, after Lori and I and all the rest of us, that they have the opportunity to have a decent retirement when they're young enough to at least appreciate it. And I won't take up any more of your time. Thank you for hearing me.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Yes,
I just, I appreciate the comments, and again, I appreciate the needing to be at the top of their game. But to the comments earlier, they aren't prisoners. There are a lot of different people at the state hospital, and it doesn't matter that but for being at the state hospital, they might be someplace else. They are at the state hospital, and I think it is really important to remember the trauma that these individuals have experienced as well, and they don't get to go home at the end of the day. I can tell you about a visit that I got to play to the forensics ward a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I was taken in, AFSCME set it up for me. I really appreciated it. The superintendent was the only person that knew I wasn't a trainee. I watched a woman who was in a panic hiding under a bed have 16 people rush into her room, lift the bed up from on top of her where she was hiding and curled in a fetal position. 5 men climbed on top of her. She begged for people to help her. They injected her with something and tied her down on a board, all because she didn't want to take a medication. So that trauma and that corrosive effect, that impacts everybody that is there, including the patients. And to call that woman an inmate or a prisoner when the person that I saw being harmed that day was this individual. And I know that there was a culture of violence in the hospital. I know that it's gotten a lot better, but the words really do matter to these individuals that have been in the shadows, have been so marginalized, abused, 3,000 souls sitting there whose ashes were in a shed. When that is the recent history that you have, the words and the language matter. So we can't sit in a hearing room and say these people are really inmates, and if it wasn't for the state hospital, they would be inmates. I can't let that go, because it goes to the dignity and humanity of the people that are there.
Right, and I would like to respond to that. I am a legal guardian of two people in the community, one who is my youngest sister and one who came this close to becoming a patient at the state hospital. So I'm very well aware, and I also work with homeless people in Salem. So I'm pretty aware of the different terminology, how things affect different people. And I know even for me, it's had a very personal impact. And for me as a staff working there, that you reach a point where you do know that there's certain places where people need to be to get the help they need. And so I don't see it as being victimized if someone gets a shot. my sister or somebody could get the same shot at Salem Hospital or Providence or wherever if they need it.
The bed lifted up from on top of them and people climbing on top of them.
Well, if they're underneath the bed or if they're using the bed for a shield. So there's many different circumstances that we're not always aware of unless we're actually the person working with the person.
Yeah, and it isn't.
So,
it
okay.
isn't.
So that's okay. There we go, sir.
No, I just the final point is the words really matter. They also matter when we are trying to move people out of the hospital and into the community, when we are trying to establish residential living for to comply with our order under the Department of Justice, and we say that they are inmates that are protected by police and fire. It makes it very difficult for us to reduce the stigma and the fear that people have in the community. So again, the idea is fine, but the words and the language really, really do matter. And I am a little frustrated because we went through this last session and the promise was that it would not come back until the language changed.
Well, and if I could just add one more thing to that.
Ma'am, one more thing. Okay, we're towards the end of our time here. It may be appropriate to have a follow-up conversation with AFSCME and with Senator Gelser. Is there something that you find really imperative to conclude with?
Well, I think, I don't know if any of you are in the community that deals with people coming out of the hospital, but when we truly start taking care of people coming out of the hospital, we will do something more than giving them a suitcase and putting them in a street corner in downtown Salem or Portland.
Thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate it.
And I thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Is there anything else? Thank you. You know, these are difficult, as you can imagine. We have all sorts of issues that come before the committee, and we want to hear folks' testimony. We try to keep it, you know, to the bill, and Senator Gelser has shared her concerns. And I think that what we do sometimes is we just take a pause for now. Take a pause, and let's address the concerns that Senator Gelser and perhaps others have in the bill. And then we can regroup and go to the next step. And then, of course, you're more than welcome to come next time when we hear the bill again. Okay? Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 811. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, March 8th. We will be talking about Senate Bill 298 in public hearings. Excuse me, we will have a work session on Senate Bill 298. So Senate Bill 298, so folks, look at that. We're going to have a work session on that. That was the Boley technical fix bill. And then we'll hear four bills concerning various workforce issues. And we're going to adjourn the meeting, Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you.
Mr. Rodman.
Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you.
Mr. Rodman.